Coming up on Tech Nation, Daniel Levitin joins me to talk about his latest neuroscience research, as well as more from the organized mind, thinking straight in the age of information overload. Then on Biotech Nation, on Bio Issue of the Week with David Ewing Duncan, David tells us about a potential new and different approach to treating Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Early diagnosis, treatment, and potential susceptibility are the focus of wide-ranging research. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
The arc of any technology is well known to each of us. You buy the newest model of something. You have the hot setup for anything from a year to just a few months, and then a newer model emerges. In truth, the technology is ultimately destined for your desk drawer, a closet or storage room, or maybe even a donation to your local public radio station, all depending on size. Of course, I'm talking about hardware devices, from cell phones to computers to automobiles. What we haven't experienced so much is that arc of our surfaces, our apps, especially in social media. We've talked about the come and go of Napster, the early rise and fall of MySpace, and even AOL, which somehow refuses to go away, charging more and more each month for services which are free all over the net. And now we have social media giants, either with huge IPOs or having been bought for billions by high-rolling tech companies. And the arc of social media appears to become something very different. I say appears to have a different arc than technical devices, because in recent conversations with any number of people, there's a confusion between stock price and actual use of social media. Stock price, as we all know, is heavily emotion and agreement, and that's a little crazy to live with. It would be like going home as a teenager to hear that dad had a disagreement with his boss, so everyone is sure he's going to get fired. All the household budgets are slashed to nothing because there'll be no money coming in. After a month of eating rice and canned soup, Dad had a good meeting with his boss, and now everyone believes he'll have a job. So the kid comes home to a buffet table laden with ham, turkey, and a big side of beef. Joyous celebration abounds, while the teenager scratches his head, and he should. Stock prices are not an indicator of the strength of social media, or who is using them, or how much. It's that arc again, the arc of the start, and how its original embodiment will be used, and ultimately that use will wane, replaced by another, and ultimately fall. Having gotten a few bad steers in terms of social media popularity, I checked the Pew reports on the demographics of key social networking platforms. Sure enough, year after year, period after period, social network use is growing on all fronts and in all age groups. But the stocks? Well, the title of a Forbes article says it all. Are social media stocks dead or just resting? Well, what isn't resting is the desire to make a killing in the stock market. There's pressure on CEOs to make predictions that say the business is growing massively quarter after quarter. And if you look at the stock price charts in social media, it would be just like the teenager's feast and famine parable. It's a roller coaster, all right, just not about the popularity of social media. But let's not forget that there are many arcs here. New uses can spring up. Teenagers always find places in real life where their parents don't go, and vice versa. No social media site can be for everyone, just like nothing is for everyone. And let's not confuse the stock market with reality. Social media is here to stay. Now let's see what we can do with it. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Daniel Levitin, who gives us his newly published neuroscience research on empathy and tells us about the organized mind, thinking straight in the age of information overload. Then on Biotech Nation, Bio Issue of the Week with David Ewing Duncan. We'll hear about a potential new and different approach to treating Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Daniel Levitin published The Organized Mind just over a year ago. I wondered, what are the top questions that people have been asking about? What are their concerns?
I think one of the biggest things is what to do about kids, people under the age of 18, who seem to have short attention spans and aren't accustomed to actually...
They're not being passive-aggressive.
Well, who knows? But I've heard it myself from students that they're not accustomed to focusing on one thing for more than 10 or 15 minutes.
Oh.
And I gave a talk about the book at Google recently, and they told me that on YouTube, the average length of time somebody watches a video is 15 seconds. So that tells you something about the attention span of the public, right?
Well, they put something out on YouTube recently of me, and there was one thumb down from 15 seconds. I don't think
right.
I appeared in the first 15 seconds.
Well, that's why. They wanted you at the top, Moira.
Yeah, right away. Down, thumbs down.
I think that that's true for some people. Some of the younger people, they're not accustomed to immersing themselves in an activity, and they want to know how to do it. And it's like anything else. You have to work up to it. And I think part of it is setting boundaries and using the exterior world to help you set those boundaries. So as your listeners know, there's a plugin for Chrome, the browser Chrome, that restricts the amount of time you would spend on Facebook or other sites. Nobody's saying those things are bad, but they do form a distraction from things that you might want to become immersed in.
I don't think we ever thought about before that we need to teach people to engage, to deeply engage, to have deep thought. It was sort of, that's what you could do. But we are so distracted now with all the information available all around us.
Well, it's interesting. It seems like it's a very 21st century, 2015 problem. But if you look at the history of people complaining about lack of engagement, it goes back a long time. When the Gutenberg press first started rolling things off, pundits were complaining this was going to be the end of civilization as we know it. People would no longer be able to engage in deep conversation or deep thought because they'd be too busy reading, for goodness sake. And Plato voiced similar concerns about the written word, that it would take people away from deep conversation when people started writing on parchments and papyrus. And
the mathematicians were really mad anyway because they didn't know what the deal was with all these words. Why
exactly.
Weren't people thinking about numbers?
Right. Who needs words? You got numbers.
Who needs words? You got numbers. Well,
here, I got one for you. 17.
17?
No, just a number.
No.
Yeah.
My favorite number is 43.
Well, of course.
No, 42 is the hitchhiker's
guide. Yeah, but you want to be
43.
One better.
I hadn't thought of it. Didn't even know that number when I got my favorite number. There you go. But
43, 17. It's a prime.
It's a prime?
Yeah.
All right. It's prime in my life, I'll tell you. Now, one of the things that, of course, came out is when we spoke last is that we're really good with places where it can be just in our mind that we put something in place, you know, the famous memory palaces about how we put things in there, but also that if we can put something in the same place, we can find it again.
Yeah.
And thank you very much. My car keys are now on the... You saved me a lot of time.
And reading glasses and passports.
Oh,
and
I haven't got the glasses down. Where are you supposed to put your glasses?
Designated place. Just designate a place and then make sure that you always put them there. It sounds kind of simple and low tech, and it is, but it's based on neuroscience, the hippocampus in the brain, the seat of place memory. And we talked about this last time. You know, this is the part of the brain that squirrels use to find their nuts. And if you think that they're using smell... intrepid scientists have done the experiment where they disconnect the olfactory sense in squirrels and the squirrels still find the nuts. But this hippocampal place memory only works for things that are static in their location. So you simply have to designate a place where your reading glasses go, your wallet, your car keys, and then they'll always be there.
It was funny.
The hippocampus will remember.
When I first started doing this, you know, I knew that there was this nail in, just inside the door that Colonel Hughes had put there. And it was like, so it was hard kind of getting it up there. You know, I'd get walk by it and stuff. But now I know if I've walked by it and I still have my keys in my hand,
yes.
I know something's wrong. It's just like you got to go back and put it there. So you can kind of train yourself. Is that part of the brain as well?
Yeah. Yeah. It's all part of externalizing. Using the exterior world as an extension of your brain, which we've been doing for thousands of years in different ways.
Now, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was some of your research. You do a lot of different kinds of research, and most recently you published Reducing Social Stress Elicits Emotional Contagion of Pain in Mouse and Human Strangers. All mice are humans are strangers to me. This is in the peer-reviewed journal Current Biology. What did you do, and how does it relate to everyday people?
So this is work I did in collaboration with Jeffrey Mogul at McGill University. And we were interested in this phenomenon that had been observed in mice, that the pain threshold of a mouse is dependent on whether it's with a familiar cage mate or a stranger. And in particular, a mouse is more sensitive to pain when it's with a friendly mouse, particularly if it sees that other mouse in pain. The mouse who's observing the pain itself becomes more sensitive. We call this emotional contagion or empathy. And the mice don't experience this when there's a stranger in the room.
An unfamiliar mouse?
Right.
Right.
An unfamiliar mouse, not a cage mate, a mouse that's new to them. Their pain thresholds are lower. They can withstand, are raised rather. They can withstand more pain. And this came to be known as stress-induced analgesia. The stress hormone, glucocorticoids, and particularly cortisol, the stress hormone, is released when you're with a stranger, and it blocks empathy and so causes you to feel less pain. And the evolutionary mechanism of this is that you don't want to be wasting empathy on somebody that you don't know and who might actually be an enemy. And we found this in humans. And the punchline of our new study was that we were able to replicate this rodentiary finding in humans, that we'd have humans come into the lab and they'd stick their arm in a bucket of ice water, 4 degrees Celsius. Very uncomfortable, painful after a few seconds. And the question was how long they can keep their hand in the ice water. If they do the experiment with a human friend who is also in pain and they can see that that friend is in pain, they have an increased sensation of pain, empathy modulated pain threshold. If we have them do it with a stranger, they can withstand more pain. Presumably, the stress of being with a stranger causes these chemical processes to kick in that block the empathy. So we did two things in our experiment. One is we administered the drug metirapone, which blocks the uptake of glucocorticoids, including cortisol.
Ooh, what does all that mean? That's a non-party drug.
You could
or
use
maybe.
It as musicians sometimes use this if they have stage fright. It blocks the stress response.
Got it.
So in blocking the stress response with this drug, we found that people with strangers experienced more pain. Their empathy returned. And then we wondered if we could do this in another way. So we had them play the game Rock Band. Now, full disclosure, Moira, The Harmonix Corporation, who invented and manufactured the video game Rock Band, gave us a copy of the game Rock Band in order to work with in the lab.
And permission to use it.
Yep. So I don't see this as a financial conflict of interest. I'm just telling you. People who played Rock Band for just 10 minutes playing...
That means two of you will play together.
Right. We brought in two strangers, right, so, who ordinarily would show increased pain. And we had them play Rock Band for 10 minutes, the Beatles version. They played two Beatles songs together, one time on guitar and the next time on bass. So one time they were George, the next time they were Paul. And after just 10 minutes of being George and Paul, the empathy effect occurred. So what we learn from this is that playing music together, at least in this particular set of circumstances, increases empathy among strangers.
Now, how did you measure the empathy toward each other when they were using the Rock Band?
After they play Rock Band, they again go to the ice cold water and see how long they can hold their hands in it.
You cruel man. No, but it's voluntary. You can always withdraw it
right at
any time. Well, were these all males or were there a mixture of men and female?
Men and women. There are gender effects, as you can imagine, if you've got opposite sex pairs in the room together. The men... you could imagine...
men become rock stars.
Right, exactly. we've done a follow-up study now where we were trying to understand more about this empathy mechanism with my doctoral student, Adil Malik. People play Rock Band, and then we give them a test that helps them helps us to assess their ability to read the emotions in other people's eyes. It's called the Reading the Mind in the Eyes test. So you're looking at facial expressions and trying to figure out what the character is feeling. And people do a lot better at that after playing Rock Band than before. So there's something about playing music with somebody that increases your awareness of others' emotions.
Now, is it just listening to music, or do you have to play it, or do you know? Science always has its limits.
You're right. So we haven't found the effect in just listening. We've only found it in playing. So we're working out the details of that, and I'll have more for you next time we talk.
So bring cymbals and a little drum on your next
date. Yeah, maybe. Yep. You can come and be a subject.
If the person doesn't run, then you'll be really good. One of the things I find so fascinating about this, because you have to kind of, you know, to really understand it, you got to think about it a bit, is how we interact with each other, how we interact in crowds, how we interact as communities and nations. I mean, there's some, it's like, are they strangers to us or do we perceive them to be friends? And, you know, this is really, it's a very interesting thing about, you know, the social dynamics, that these are sort of seeds potentially informing how we all interact with each other.
I'm glad you brought that up. One of the things that sociologists and social psychologists are teaching us is that just spending time with people from other cultures goes an enormous way toward lowering what we would have seen as cultural barriers or hostilities. Just spending time with them. I was fortunate to spend time at Esalen back in 2009 with a group of individuals who had come over from Jerusalem, half of them from the Palestinian territories in Jerusalem and the other half who considered themselves Israelites, so Muslims and Jews. And these are people who have been at war with each other since the dawn of recorded history and who feel great antipathy towards one another as a group. I mean, you know, as an abstract group. But at Esalen, all the barriers came down. They discovered they had much more in common with each other than they had differences with one another. And there were a group of mothers there who were very concerned about the effects of the conflict on their kids. They shared that. It was tremendously eye-opening and heart-opening.
And heart-opening as well. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Daniel Levitin. He's the Dean of Social Sciences at the Minerva Schools at the Keck Graduate Institute. You might know him from This Is Your Brain on Music. He's here today with The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. Now, the Keck Graduate Institute is a renowned institute, and it's located in Claremont in Southern California. But the Minerva Schools are here in San Francisco. Tell us about that. Tell us about their programs.
So Keck Graduate Institute, by the name, is a graduate program specializing in the sciences, and they're part of the Claremont Consortium. And we are their undergraduate program. And we're located in San Francisco, our administrative offices, but our students travel around the world. What we aim to provide is a global education to the leaders and innovators of tomorrow. And to that end, we understand that the world is increasingly globalized, that it doesn't make sense to think about local interests anymore. We're an interdependent economy, an interdependent set of social issues today. So our students spend their first year, their freshman year here in San Francisco, and then every semester they go off in cohorts of 150 students to other cities in the world. So, for example, they'll go to Buenos Aires and Berlin, and we're working on what the other cities will be after that, but they'll be all over the world. London is one of the possibilities.
And when you go there, are you affiliated with another university?
You're with Minerva. So
Minerva goes with you.
Yeah, so, you know, the way that we conduct our classroom is they're all seminars. We believe that it's important to use the science of learning in how we teach. We're trying to reinvent the university experience. No class has more than 19 students because there's a big literature now that lectures are the least effective way of learning. They're effective for the teacher. They're ineffective for the student. It's a way for a teacher to address a bunch of people at once, but it's a very poor way for anyone to learn. So we're trying to put students first. Seminars capped at 19 people. The students attend class on their laptops. So
they don't come to school.
Well, they come to school in real time. Class is at 9 or at 10:15 or at...
You better be on your laptop.
You open up your laptop if you're one of the 19 students in that class on that day, and the camera on your laptop sends a feed to our learning platform, the Active Learning Forum. And the professor also is logged in, and everybody sees each other on the screen, and we all interact in real time through this interface, which allows for a very accelerated classroom experience. Students don't have time to drift off or check Facebook or, you know, let their attention flag for a moment because all eyes are on them all the time. And the workspace allows us to do a number of things that are very difficult in a traditional classroom. You can collaboratively edit documents together in real time, whether they're equations or math simulations or computer code or engineering problems written, you know, English assignments, and we can run simulations in real time and have 3D modeling and all this kind of stuff, and we tape all of the classroom sessions, so that later that same day the professor goes and looks at everything the student did and gives them immediate feedback, and can point to they're tagged to parts of the classroom. 13 minutes and 45 seconds into the class, you said this. And this is, you know, how I'm evaluating your comment.
Well, you know, these things is incorporating this in teaching style and pedagogy. You know, finally there's enough technology. We don't have to look at just a single technology, but integrated technologies. For instance, I'm thinking of one course that I teach to adults at night. It starts at 6:30. Most of them have worked all day. And it's like you bring the paper to class. We're still in person to person there. But you file it electronically by 2 p.m. It's like, I know when you filed it.
Exactly.
I know you filed it during class.
Right.
I knew that. And it's like when you figure, wait a minute, I can see this quality is the person not getting it, is that the person didn't do his homework, you know, and it's like, okay, there we go, you know. So these things are very informative and undeniable. But another thing that I see that I've started to introduce for particularly difficult classes where each student has to engage and build something and you have to keep moving along because you'll get lost, is that I have a one-on-one time where you hand your homework in. I'm going to hand you the stuff that we corrected. I'm going to see what you handed me right now, and we can talk about this or that. And it's like, great, we got it. While the other students are there, and they're interacting. And it's like, it's this really interesting phenomenon that I was like, well, I'll give this a go. And I've had them tell me again and again now, the students tell me, boy, that was so helpful. I was missing this and I couldn't figure out how to do it. And Joe helped me and we went. And, you know, there's just a couple of rules. If somebody says, I don't want your help, we're looking at there saying, I know what to do, you know. But it's like, yeah, we're all together in this. So the enabling of technology and the presence of technology, the fact that you can look at everybody's face, not just the teacher, but every student in there, it changes enormously the interchange.
And on our platform, we create breakout groups. We might, in a 90-minute class, we might throw groups of four or five students at a time into a breakout group.
So you only see those four or five
on
your screen.
And they come up collaborative, getting to your point about how important it is for students to help one another and collaborate. They'll work for 12 or 13 minutes, come up with a solution, and bring it to the whole class when everyone reconvenes. You know, and this, I'm glad you brought up this working together. What we're trying to do in the Minerva curriculum is promote four big ideas. One is that we want to teach all of our students to collaborate with one another, and we want to teach them leadership. And part of leadership that's not often talked about in MBA programs and typical leadership programs that we're teaching even our freshmen is know when you should be the leader and when you shouldn't, right? Know if there's a better leader in the group. Or when it's just a better idea to let someone else lead, and know what your role is then and how to make the team succeed as a follower, not just as a leader. That kind of, I think, people smarts is something that can be taught and is something that's crucial. So interacting effectively is one of the four. Another is communicating effectively. We think it doesn't do you any good to know everything that you need to know if you can't share it with others in a way that scales the way you describe it, depending on their background and their own interests. A third area is thinking critically. And a fourth area is thinking creatively, problem solving. And we teach these skills in a focused way during the freshman year, using content from traditional courses like physics and biology and engineering and neuroscience and psychology and literature and economics. And then during the rest of their 4 years at Minerva, they put these into practice in a variety of courses.
Well, there's no doubt about it. When you travel to another place, it's like, holy moly, everything's changed. We're going to put this into practice. And yet you can obviously keep track of everything back at headquarters.
Yes.
You don't have to have all 4 years of your students here in San Francisco. You just have this year's class.
And we don't have to have all the professors here. So we've identified people who we think are among the very best professors anywhere, and they teach from wherever they happen to be.
I'm speaking with Daniel Levitin, the author of The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, it's Bio Issue of the Week with David Ewing Duncan. The subject is a potential new and different approach to treating Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Daniel Levitin, the Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva Schools at the Keck Graduate Institute, and author of The Organized Mind.
We teach these skills in a focused way during the freshman year, using content from traditional courses like physics and biology and engineering and neuroscience and psychology and literature and economics. And then during the rest of their 4 years at Minerva, they put these into practice in a variety of courses.
Well, there's no doubt about it. When you travel to another place, it's like, holy moly, everything's changed. We're going to put this into practice. And yet you can obviously keep track of everything back at headquarters.
Yes.
You don't have to have all 4 years of your students here in San Francisco. You just have this year's class.
And we don't have to have all the professors here. So we've identified people who we think are among the very best professors anywhere, and they teach from wherever they happen to be. So, often you'll find somebody who is recently retired, and they are no longer a member of their university, but they're still active. And
they don't want to teach a full load.
Right, that's right. Or you find somebody who didn't get tenure because their research wasn't good enough, but their teaching was off the charts. We want them, of course.
Come on down.
Yeah.
So that it's an interesting, you're reassembling things in a very, very interesting way. I know everyone will want me to ask you, are the students generally 18, typical college age when they come in, and what are the majors or the major that they would pursue?
We have 17 and 18 year olds, but some older students as well, 20, 21. We have students who began at another university, and when they heard about Minerva, were willing to come here, not as transfer students, but to start all over as freshmen, because they have to take our freshman core of those four big areas. We have a couple of students who were in the Israeli Army. They did their service, and so they're older and coming now starting university for the first time. And they're majoring. We have four colleges. We've got a College of Social Sciences, Computational Sciences, Arts and Humanities, and natural sciences, and those are the majors, and then within the majors there are subspecialties.
So in a sense, your degree in the end will look on paper like another degree. Just know
yes.
that it's Minerva.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And we've worked closely with graduate programs and employers to understand what their needs are so that they'll be able to interpret what it is that we're offering.
Yes. Well, parents are glad to hear these are employable skills. No doubt about that. Now, I'm going to take a little turn here. I think a lot of people don't recognize or would think that you've had experience as a stand-up comedian, a very successful one at that. Tell us about that.
Well, I was living here in San Francisco in the 1980s and working for a local record company, 415 Records. We were affiliated with Columbia Records, and indeed Howie Klein, our president, sold the company to Sony in 1989. But during the time I was working as a producer and staff arranger, it was the heyday of stand-up comedy, or the rebirth.
Oh, in San Francisco, that was the time to be here. Yeah.
Dana Carvey and
Robin Williams.
Yep,
whole crowd
got to share a stage with Robin and with Dana, and Bobcat Goldthwait. I mean, it was really a happening scene, and so I worked up a routine and I performed at some of the local clubs and. I guess the high point of it was that I came in second place in the National Lampoon stand-up comedy competition.
Were they serious?
I thought it was
a joke.
I hope
so. But... Wait a minute. Let me see who else is on this roster.
Right.
Well, the reason I asked you about that is that in thinking about it, I think being a comedian and working up your own material, I think that helps with being a scientist.
I wonder if that's true. I'd have to see the data.
It's anecdotal.
Yeah.
What I'm thinking is everything I know about what makes me laugh and what I think is funny are frequently, and it's, I'm sort of into the comedy of the absurd. Like
yeah.
these two things shouldn't go together. And
yeah.
suddenly we've made them go together and you laugh. That's the little spark across your brain. So many times in science, you're laying down new tracks. This wasn't supposed to quite go with that. Well, maybe that could go with that. So there's this this sort of process that I look at saying, maybe there's something to that, that sort of constant different thinking, putting things together.
I'm interested to hear you describe it that way. I agree, and I never thought of it that way. I think the way I always thought of it is that something that comedy and music and science have in common is that to be good in any of them, you have to have an innate curiosity. You have to just be curious about things, how things work, how they go together, how they don't go together. And then another point in common is that I think anything creative, and science requires some creativity, coming up with new hypotheses. Anything creative requires that you put together things that hadn't been seen as going together before. And I think the classic way to define comedy and music, their commonality, is that somebody is leading you down a path, and at some point you end up in a different place than you thought you would. And in comedy, that's funny. And in music, that's the great thrill of a resolution that you didn't see coming, a musical resolution. And in science, of course...
Let's publish.
Well, right. You publish something that nobody knew before, right? That's what science is. And they didn't know it because it was some path that nobody had been down before.
To me, I see, especially, you know, as I'm reading all of your things and knowing you and reading this book, I mean, it really was starting to all come together for me just in that. And we've forgotten all the work that you've done just in music alone. I mean, a recent publication.
I haven't forgotten.
Well, I said we. I was busy doing other things, Daniel. I don't think about you every day, you know. So my apologies. But a recent publication from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, you write on expert violinists can't tell old from new. What were you writing about then?
Oh, you know, there's been this battle in science trying to figure out why it is that so many people claim that they can reliably tell the difference between two things that are similar, and yet in the laboratory they can't. This plays out in a way that will interest you and our engineer, Howard, in the audio wars. Musicians and producers and engineers have been saying, oh, well, you know, CDs are crap because the quality isn't high enough. You need to have super high resolution audio. And there have been a number of experiments now that show that people can't tell the difference between the super high resolution and the CDs. And in most cases, can't even tell between CDs and a good MP3 if it's properly encoded at a high bit rate. Yet they think they can. So as somebody trained in psychology, I can tell you part of what's going on there is something we call an illusory correlation. Every time that we get something right, a guess about something in the world, like, oh, I thought that was an MP3, and then you look and it is. Or I thought that was the CD, and you look and it is. Every time you get something right, your brain encodes that as a hit, as a correct response. The brain's not as good at remembering the misses, and so it's not running the statistical tables that a scientist would run in an actual experiment. Now, with this violins old and new, it's the same story. Violinists kept saying these multi-million-dollar Stradivarii, but when given an opportunity to do a blind test where they actually have a blindfold and they play them both, they can't tell the difference. And, you know, I was writing in the Proceedings of the National Academy about what I think should be the nail in the coffin of the argument. This is such a carefully done study. They got professional world-class violinists to be the participants in the experiment. They not only played in the laboratory, but they could play in a concert hall. They could have another person who they trusted sit out in the audience and help them judge. And they still couldn't tell the difference.
Statistics don't lie in this particular case. Well, what do you think that is about humans? I know you described the mechanism, but the sense of many times we just believe what we want to believe.
Well, you know, part of it is, I had the wonderful experience as a student to work in the laboratory of Amos Tversky at Stanford, collaborated with Danny Kahneman when Danny was at Berkeley. He's now at Princeton. And as you know, he won the Nobel Prize in economics, and Kahneman did, and had this wonderful book called Thinking, Fast and Slow. And Kahneman and Tversky point out that the brain just isn't configured to make proper, rational, statistical judgments. That's what Kahneman won the Nobel for. And we see this in so many aspects of our lives, that our brains are not keeping track of the statistics the way that you would if you were writing down everything. So how many times has it happened to you that you were thinking of somebody and they called on the phone?
I know.
So the brain pays attention to that and it thinks, wow, weird. That's got to be something more than coincidence. But let me approach this from two sides. One is, the world is so vast, the universe is so vast, and there are so many billions of events unfolding every moment, that there are some things that are going to happen by pure random chance. They're going to seem like they're otherworldly and they're amazing and you can't explain them. But with billions of events happening per minute, there are going to be a certain number of these things that happen, and they're going to be surprising. And you're going to think that it's some supernatural force, but it just falls out of the statistics. That's one way to come at it. The other is, as I mentioned, the brain only pays attention to these coincidences. But to really ask yourself, is this unusual that I was thinking about Arlene and Arlene called me? You have to ask, how many times do I think about Arlene and she doesn't call me? In fact, everybody in my life, how many times do I think about them and they don't call? How many times do I get a call from somebody I wasn't thinking about? And then there's the fourth cell that you need in the equation. How many times am I not thinking about somebody and they don't call?
Yeah, most of the time.
You need all that information in order to determine whether the other one was really outside of the realm of probability. And it's not.
Well, I get such a kick out of reading these things. It does two things for me when I read your work and this latest book, The Organized Mind. There's a portion of our brains that are very almost mechanistic. Then the other part is that we've somehow gotten here believing what we need to believe. I mean, if we literally could look at the truth, we wouldn't get out of bed. I mean, it's like all of these possibilities and all that, we've got this threshold and ability to go forward.
You know, what Kahneman showed in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, is the myriad ways that the brain was not configured to make good judgments based on intuition. And there are tools that you can learn that will help you. In fact, that's one of the reasons I wrote The Organized Mind, was to share some of these tools. And there's a whole chapter devoted to medical decision making, which is very simple.
Everybody needs.
If you break it down, it's very simple. But you have to learn it. And it doesn't take more than 15 minutes to learn. But, you know, you got to learn it or you're going to make bad decisions. And you're right. Humans have come a long way. We're, by many accounts, the most successful species in the history of the planet. We can manage to survive in almost every corner of the globe. And we've conquered almost every corner of the globe. I mean, we've created great infrastructures there. But on the other hand, you know, we've got some problems. If we don't kill ourselves from climate change, we could kill ourselves, you know, with some errant nuclear weapons or with genocides or the kinds of aggressions we see across borders and within borders. We've got terrible problems with poverty and hunger. So somebody who sees those every day, somebody who's working in a third world country, Doctors Without Borders, my own physician has spent in San Francisco, spends a lot of time overseas, people in the clergy, they don't report the story that humans are doing pretty good. They're seeing the darker underbelly of our failures and our failures to be able to solve these problems using intuition, which is why I think that training, this is why I've devoted my life to education, really, Moira, is that I think that education can make all the difference, giving the next generation the tools they need to think better, to think creatively, to apply that knowledge to make the world a better place. These are the credos of Minerva, make the world a better place.
Daniel, thank you. Thank you for all the time I've gotten back not searching for my keys. And please come back. See us anytime.
Nice to see you.
My guest today is Daniel Levitin. The book is The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. It's now out in paperback. It's published by Plume, an imprint of Penguin Random House. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation.
The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we talk about a potential new and different approach to treating Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia on Bio Issue of the Week with David Ewing Duncan. In 2015, an estimated 5.3 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease. Of those, 96%, that's over 5 million Americans, are over the age of 65. 85% are over the age of 75. Considering all forms of dementia, over the age of 70, one out of seven suffers. More women than men suffer from dementia, representing some two-thirds of those diagnosed. Early diagnosis, treatment, and potential susceptibility are the focus of wide-ranging research, along with the likely impact of population aging. The first born from the huge post-World War II baby boom are now turning 70, while modern medicine, including biotech, are enabling them to live longer and longer. I commented to David, baby boomers are getting older by the minute, while the statistics on Alzheimer's and dementia are rising at an unprecedented pace. Are we also seeing a rise in better diagnostics and treatment?
Well, Moira, actually, this is a story that is quite alarming. And anybody that's around elderly people, and we have more and more of them, I mean, my parents are in their 80s, we know that this is an enormous problem. And the pharmaceutical industry, healthcare, the NIH has spent literally tens of billions of dollars trying to figure out a treatment, never mind a cure to Alzheimer's and other types of dementia, and really has largely failed. And it's possible, though, and why I'm bringing you this not so happy news, there is a potential, movement on the dial here that might
a silver lining.
Yes, or well, even more than that, it might actually be a totally different way of looking at Alzheimer's and dementia or the causes of it that might indicate it's not a simple solution, but certainly a different one and one that we understand. And not to draw it out too long, it looks like there's a chance that bacteria, those little critters that are inside of us, they're 100
everywhere.
Yeah, there are 100 trillion
dismay.
Of us inside of us. I mean, it's sort of hard. It's us and our microbes. It's not just us. But some of the bad actors among microbes may get into the brain and be the culprits here.
So from our gut to our brain.
Yes, that's one possibility. The pathogens that I'm going to tell you about in a minute have not been identified. They're still secret, with the people that have identified them. Yes. Well, they're just trying to keep it quiet while they develop a company. And we will find out very soon because they're going to be publishing some studies and things. But presumably it comes from the gut because there's a whole new wave of research, fairly recent. It's been around for a while, but it's kind of reaching its own now, about the idea that the blood-brain barrier, which was supposed to and is supposed to filter out most intruders like bacteria, viruses.
Bad actors.
Right, from the brain. The brain's pretty – we don't want, those kind of things messing around too much with the brain. But that, in fact, various things happen, like a brain trauma. You get your head knocked around playing football or
you're in a
lot
car
of,
accident.
Right, whatever it is. And as you age, that blood-brain barrier begins to deteriorate, and some of these bad little bugs can get in. And it appears that one of these varieties of bugs, probably coming from the gut because they do get distributed around the body, and we bring in through our mouth, our digestive system, a lot of stuff from the outside. So it's likely that it does come from the gut. It could come from elsewhere, but that's probably where it comes from. And anyway, these guys get in there, and what happens is we know from Alzheimer's there's a protein. There's a number of forms of Alzheimer's, but the most prevalent is that the brain begins to produce amyloid beta proteins, which are essentially an immune response to something going on, and it may be these bacteria.
What was the source of potentially connecting bacteria to dementia in the brain.
I just heard a talk recently about this whole notion of bacteria being connected to Alzheimer's by somebody that you and I both know, Casey Lynch, who's been involved with the Neurotechnology Industry Organization. And she heard about a researcher at UCSF named Steve Dominy.
Dr. Dominy.
Yes. And yes. So many of Dr. Dominy's patients have AIDS, and he treats them. And one of the things that he treats and researches is a very common side effect, a really horrible side effect of AIDS patients, which is that they get AIDS-related dementia. And his theory and his work is around the idea that bacteria may be behind this. So he was researching this and discovered, and again, we don't know the details here. They haven't published it yet.
But we're watching every day.
We're watching it. But apparently, in this research, he discovered a bacteria that he believes is connected with Alzheimer's and dementia. So that's how this happened. Casey Lynch, who, you know, sits around basically studying neuroscience
everything
companies.
Everything neuro, Casey knows. Yeah.
She thought this was so interesting and checked it out with all of her wide network of people that she actually has become the CEO and co-founder of a new company called Cortexamy. And they've just raised $2.5 million. Peter Thiel's Breakout Labs has funded them, the Dolby Family Fund, some others. And she is off and running and is a strong believer in this notion. And for the article I wrote about this, I checked it out with some leading Alzheimer's researchers. And the idea of bacteria causing Alzheimer's is not new, but it's very fringe.
Wait and see.
Yeah. Well,
but this is a UCSF researcher. This is significant. This is a significant person. You know, we're not talking about somebody who just said, well, I think so, so we'll just go off here. They do serious science at UCSF.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I checked with another UCSF researcher, Michael Weiner, who is one of the most prominent Alzheimer's researchers in the world. And he told me that this is, you know, still out there, but he would like to see the data, but he is not dismissing it. And I also talked to Rudy Tanzi, who is another famous Alzheimer's researcher in Boston at Harvard. And his lab has actually been studying this and knows something about it and also wanted to see the research. But, you know, we don't know yet. This could be a flash in the pan, but there are, you know, some indications that it makes some sense.
Well, none of the current drugs in the pipeline, of which there are over 100 in various stages from various companies going after Alzheimer's, none of them are taking this approach. This kind of reminds me of what happened when they discovered what causes ulcers, stomach ulcers.
Well, the whole bacteria story, the microbiome story, is a fascinating one. You know, not too many years ago, we were basically thinking of them as the enemy. You know, you had to wash your hands, you know, antibiotics if you got some kind of infection. And, you know, we wanted to get rid of these things. It's been fairly recent that we've discovered that, first of all, they're everywhere. There's good bacteria, there's bad bacteria. But we're discovering more and more that this may be an explanation for many diseases. And, in fact, not only bad things, but good things. There was a study, there was an article in the New York Times Magazine recently about a lot of interesting research around bacteria affecting mood and literally could be at least complicit in depression and, you know, other mood disorders. So this is an emerging area. But you mentioned ulcers. There's actually a wonderful story about first of all, it's about how the biomedical industry and physicians and others can have an orthodoxy that's completely overturned, which might, you know, could happen here. There was a fellow named Barry Marshall in Australia who was sure that H. pylori, which is a bacteria in the gut, was causing ulcers. And this was back in the 70s and 80s. And the orthodoxy said, no way, it's spicy food, it's stress.
Drink milk.
Yeah, I mean,
people
were getting
coffee.
Yeah, they're getting surgery around ulcers. I remember this. My grandmother had them and had some surgery. And so he was so convinced that he actually got a little petri dish of H. pylori. This is not stuff that you want to have, you know, want to like drink, you know, with a cocktail.
Warning, what's coming up here.
Right. So he just, you know, quaffed some of this, put it right, you know, drank it right down and, you know, got ulcers and proved his case. And
I don't believe in bio issue of the week that much. I just wanted to put that out there.
you're not going to be
you're
drinking.
You're going to have to tell me about this stuff.
Yeah, I have a little vial here, Mara. I want you to drink.
So he actually tried it, and he got ulcers. And that's the ultimate proof, because he really couldn't do it to somebody else, you know.
Right. And, well, no one would believe him.
And then he was able to cure himself with antibiotics.
Yeah, antibiotics, which is a pretty simple cure. And he won the 2005 Nobel Prize with a couple of others. And it's now the standard of care to treat
and
with antibiotics.
And the common talk, one third of the talk at a cocktail party is not, how's your ulcer, Harry?
Yeah, right. I mean, this is a really easily treated
It was just
condition.
Prevalent throughout the population.
Yeah. So
this could be the same thing. It has that potential.
It could be. That's the hope. And Cortexme, you know, it is a company, and they are.
And can you spell that for people?
Yeah, it's Cortexyme.
So Cortexyme.
Yes. Uh-huh. And they are hoping to develop an antibiotic, you know, that could potentially treat this bacteria. And obviously a lot of work has to be done here. Now, these bacteria, I was told by Casey Lynch, are resistant to most current antibiotics.
It would have to be a precision treatment for that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be careful in the brain, I was told by Casey. Anyway, you know, a lot of these antibiotics sort of blow up or destroy the bacteria. That releases toxins. You know, it's one thing if it's in your blood or in tissue that can absorb that. The brain, again, is pretty delicate. So they want to have a really targeted. And there's a whole next generation of antibiotics that are being developed that attack parts of a bacteria, you know, like the protease or other, you know, enzymes or other activity proteins, which basically shut down their ability to do the bad things but don't cause them to explode or something.
Well, let's keep our eye on this, and when she's ready, let's get Casey in here and talk to her.
Let's do it.
You got it. Hey, thanks for coming in, David.
See you next week.
David Ewing Duncan is the chief correspondent for Biotech Nation. His biotech blogs can be found at experimentalman.com. The company mentioned in this bio issue of the week is Cortexme, headed by CEO and co-founder Casey Lynch. More information is available on the web at cortexme.com. That's Cortex, C-O-R-T-E-X, Cortex, Y-M-E, cortexme.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.